It's a classic computing interview session, the John Sculley interview, part two. In part two of our interview, we discuss HyperCard, Cray supercomputers, QuickTime, General Magic, Larry Tesler, the Newton, ARM, Marvin Minsky, and more.
There was an engineer who was actually the first engineer that Steve Jobs ever hired at Apple, named Bill Atkinson. And Bill was not only the first Apple II engineer, but he was also, you know, a lead engineer on the Macintosh team. Mm-hmm. After Steve left, Bill became an Apple Fellow, which meant he could go work on projects that he wanted to. And one day I got a call from Alan Kay in about 1987, and he said, "John, you got to go talk to Bill Atkinson." And I said, "Well, what's wrong?" He said, "Well, Bill's in tears. He said the engineers are really beating up on him because they say he should stop fooling around with this project he has, and he should go, you know, help them out on getting the next Mac release out." And I said, "Well, what's the project?" He said, "Well, you got to see it. It is really clever, and it is, you know, part of what's going to be needed to be solved if there's ever going to be a knowledge navigator, you know, in the future." And so I went and looked at it, and the product later became known as HyperCard. And HyperCard was the first use of graphics-based radio buttons where you could click on an object and it could link you to something else on the screen. It was actually going back to some of the ideas that Ted Nelson had, even back to Vannevar Bush's ideas of interactivity and hyper text and things of that sort. And Bill actually implemented it on a Macintosh.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I said, "Okay, Bill," I said, "why don't you move your office next to my cube?" So he actually had his cube next to mine. And I said, "You can go work on that, but I've got two conditions. The first condition is, you know, I'll fund it out of my office, and we'll try to develop it as a product, but you've got to have a scripting language to go with it so that people can actually, you know, create their own applications from it." And I wasn't a programmer, but I did understand that the Mac was very hard to program, and that unless we had a simple scripting tool, that we weren't going to get much adoption of the what became HyperCard. So Bill agreed to that, and he brought in another engineer to work with him on the scripting language. And then I said, "I've got a second point I want you to agree to," which is I was interviewed by this guy, Danny Goodman, for a profile in Playboy. And
okay.
I looked at Danny, and I thought he was just an exceptionally good writer. And I read some of the books he wrote on, you know, how to use computers.
Right.
And I said, "Will you agree to have Danny sit alongside of you while you're creating HyperCard and write the story and explain to people so we have a written handbook that goes along with the scripting language?" And so Bill got to meet Danny. They hit it off, and Danny did that. So HyperCard became three parts. It became the product itself, it became the scripting language, mm-hmm. and it became Danny Goodman's book, you know, on how to create, you know, all kinds of, you know, interactive graphics-based applications using HyperCard. Just to give a little context to history, one of the big users of HyperCard was the High Performance Computing Lab at the University of Illinois at Urbana. And they were taking Cray XMP48 supercomputers, and they were using Macs with HyperCard as the front end and enabling them to connect the Macintosh over the internet. Remember, in those days, there was no World Wide Web, mm-hmm. Back to the supercomputer. And it was at that lab, I think, you can check with Mark Andreessen, I think that's the very lab that Mark Andreessen was working in at that time. So I give Bill Atkinson a lot of credit for, you know, being one of the first guys, even before Tim Berners-Lee or even before Netscape, you know, were created. You know, Bill was actually, you know, developing, you know, a tool that enabled the Macintosh to have a graphics user interface over the internet to be able to control an XMP 48 supercomputer. So that's sort of another, you know, historical piece to the puzzle. Another piece to the puzzle was that Jean-Louis Gasset, who was heading up Apple's technology after Steve left, wanted to be able to simulate what graphics-based computing would be like when you could actually manipulate 3D geometries. And back in 1987, you couldn't do that. You could just barely raster a photographic image, and it would take, you know, better part of, you know, a couple of minutes just to photograph at a relatively low resolution a black and white photograph on a screen, more or less manipulate a 3D object. So Jean-Louis came with a proposal, which I supported, that we asked the Apple board to spend $28 million, which was a lot of money in those days, to buy a Cray supercomputer, which we installed in its own building. And Jean-Louis Gasset's engineers used it to do simulations for building the interactive tools and understanding, you know, how do you manipulate an object in 3D, much the way computers, again, with Moore's Law, would eventually be able to do off of a personal computer, right, you know, 4, 5, 6 years later. So the power of that XMP48, which we bought for $28 million, was the equivalent of about 50 MIPS, million instructions per second, or today's we say, you know, megahertz. So it's you know, that $28 million computer was about as powerful as, you know, one of the chips we have in a watch,
right,
today for a couple of bucks, which is how consistent Moore's Law is. But it was extremely valuable for Apple to figure out how do we manipulate multimedia. And I'd always been interested in you know, multimedia coming out of, you know, marketing and advertising and stuff. And our engineers were very interested in it. We had a very talented engineer named Steve Perlman, who also was having challenges getting along with the kind of the mainstream engineers. And so I moved Steve over to my office. And so he sat outside my office, my cube as well. And he was the one who developed the first microprocessor assist, which could run what we called QuickTime, which was our multimedia, you know, engine for the Macintosh. And Mac was the first personal computer that could actually do multimedia. And that was Steve Perlman who created that. And why was this all significant to me? Because it, to me, it was just another step along the way to the Knowledge Navigator. You know, you had to do something like HyperCard, had to do something like QuickTime. And all of these things, if Alan Kay was correct, would be commonplace 20 years later. But in the late 1980s, these things were highly experimental, and really nobody else was working on them. I mean, we had pretty good knowledge of what other people were working on in different labs, and they weren't working on these kinds of problems. So the...
Yeah, certainly QuickTime was a very breakthrough technology and a leader in that category.
As you know, Steve Perlman went on to found a number of successful companies. His most recent one is pretty amazing, called OnLive. And OnLive is doing real-time video games, you know, over, you know, tablets and smartphones and things of this sort from the cloud. And you know, Steve has been one of those remarkable individuals who can not only think about the future, but can actually go and build it. So, you know, these people from a historical standpoint, you know, were, you know, key innovators for what we know as present day computing. The other thing which I became interested in was a small company that was started by two former Apple engineers on the Mac team.
I think I know.
Hertzfeld. Bill Atkinson, along with a third individual who wasn't from Apple, named Mark Barat, and it was called General Magic. And their idea was that, this is before the World Wide Web, that the future was going to be about small handheld devices that were going to be mostly about communications, and they would have a lot of smarts built into them, and that they were going to be even more important than personal computers eventually. So I sponsored that product out of my office. We invested in it. They were a separate company. I was on the board of it. And they worked with AT&T and Sony as partners in it. And the thing probably would have been successful, except Tim Berners-Lee came along and invented the World Wide Web. And then all of a sudden, things called cell phones became popular in the 1990s. And all that eclipsed, you know, what General Magic was doing. Inside of Apple, there were several competing projects. There was a project inside of the Macintosh team that was working on a handheld Mac. There was another project called Newton, started by a small team that spun out of the Mac group. And when I got involved with it, and heard about it, Larry Tesler. Larry had been the engineer at Xerox PARC who had led Steve Jobs around to see the Alto and the Star, which were the inspirations for the Lisa, which later was, you know, to become the Macintosh inspiration. And Larry left Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, joined Apple, was a key engineer inside of Apple for many years, and then later became the head of the Newton team. And what intrigued me about Newton was that while I was totally opposed to licensing the Macintosh technology, because I didn't know how we could do it without destroying Apple as a company, I was completely open-minded to the idea that Apple should do its next generation of where computing was going after the Macintosh. It should do it with a very different model, and it should build the microprocessor as well as the software. And we went, and this is, I give the credit to Larry Tesler on this one. Larry realized that if you're going to do very sophisticated graphics manipulation on a handheld product, that no processor existed at that time that was both powerful and low-powered enough to be able to even attempt that. So Larry Tesler found a man in the UK named Herman Hauser, who had founded the Acorn Computer Company. Herman was a professor in computer science from Cambridge University. And Herman designed a microprocessor that was very low powered, which you had to have for a handheld device, that could handle graphics. So it had a very sophisticated architecture to it, with floating point architecture. You needed floating point for graphics. We developed up it with a team we founded out of MIT up in Kendall Square, a software team which developed an operating system that was really closer to the work Alan Kay had done with Smalltalk and a following operating system called Schema back in the 1970s. But now with the floating point technology of the early 1990s, you could actually do this, at some pretty high performance levels. And it had unique features like garbage collection and, object manipulation and things of that sort. All of that technology was built into a product called Newton. The thing which I did not understand, because I wasn't a computer engineer, that I didn't understand that the things we were working on were probably still 15 years away from being realistic in the marketplace. And so at the same time that we were developing Newton, Donna Dubinsky, who used to work at Apple, had left to co-found a company called Palm Pilot. And they took one of the oldest processor architectures, the 8088, that Intel had developed. And it was just at the time when cell phones were becoming popular in the mid-1990s. And it was at the same time that the World Wide Web had now led to email becoming popular. And there was no directory. There was no phone book for either email addresses or for cell phone numbers. And so the brilliance of the Palm Pilot was it didn't take much technology to create a synchronizing engine and a storage device that would let you hook up to any personal computer and download your contact list onto this little device. And that was the Palm Pilot. And the brilliance of it was that it took a real problem and solved it in a very simple way. Mm-hmm. We, on the other hand, with Newton, took a very complex problem, and we were solving it in a very sophisticated way. And I wasn't, you know, experienced enough to know that it was actually going to be, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years later before the things we were envisioning with Newton became practical. So in the last speech I gave at CES was in January of 1993. And it was at that time that Bill Gates always gave the Sunday night keynote. I gave the keynote, I think, on Monday. And my keynote was about the future of what was called convergence in those days, of when communications, computing, and content were going to come together. Mm-hmm. And you would be able to have all kinds of new services that would combine each of these things, communications, computing, and content. And the device that I talked about, I said, is going to be called a PDA. And I'd come up with the name PDA just because we needed a name, just like we did with Knowledge Navigator. It's not that it couldn't have been a different name. I couldn't use PC, personal communicator, because PC was already, you know, right, had a legacy a meaning to it. So I said, why don't we call it, just as we did in the Knowledge Navigator, you know, a personal digital assistant. So we called it a PDA. So I gave the speech at CES in January of 1993. And I said, in the future, there are going to be these small devices, and we're going to introduce one ourselves called Newton. And we call it a PDA, a personal digital assistant. And they're going to sell in the billions. And by sell in the billions, I was not talking about Newton. I was talking about, you know, that these devices were going to be far more pervasive than personal computers. At that time, there were probably 150 million, you know, personal computers sold a year. So the idea that you would be selling anything in the billions seemed completely absurd. Well, I got completely ridiculed in the press for that speech. And I think if you go back, even the Wall Street Journal said, Scully announces that Apple's going to introduce a product that they're going to sell in the billion. And I didn't say that, you know, any more than I fired Steve Jobs. Right. What I said was that there are going to be these personal digital assistants in the future, and we were going to introduce one ourselves, and they would ultimately be sold in the billions, you know, a year. So I was wrong by 20 years. And as you know, those, whether it's iPhones or Blackberries or Android devices, are actually, there are billions of them sold every year. The part of the story that most people don't know is that the microprocessor that Larry Tesler helped create for the Newton was a new company that we had to put together that was 47% owned by Apple. It was 47% owned by Olivetti, a name from the past, mm-hmm. and the rest of it was owned by Herman Hauser. And this company we called ARM, A-R-M. And while the Newton was not commercially successful, it was, you know, too for its time, the ARM processor became the core of every mobile device that's sold today. ARM, I think, is probably about a $26 or $27 billion market cap company today. After I was pushed out of Apple decided to license the technology and stopped making, you know, one or two cool products a year, made many, many different, you know, products. And the company started to spiral into huge losses. When I left Apple, we had about $2 billion of cash. We had maybe $200 million of debt. And by the time Steve Jobs came back, Apple was almost bankrupt. Mm-hmm. The decision that really helped keep the doors open, and I give Gil Amelio credit for two things. One was he sold the 47% that Apple owned of ARM for about $800 million, so I'm told. And that $800 million was crucial to keeping Apple alive. And he brought Steve Jobs back. And if those two things hadn't have happened, there never would have been the rest of the story. And ironically, today, if you look at the iPad and you go back and look at the Knowledge Navigator, mm-hmm. Alan's concepts, I was just part of the team, there are remarkably similarities between them. If you look at any of the Apple devices beyond Macintosh, iPhone, iPad, they all run on the ARM core. And again, I take no credit on inventing any of this stuff or having the visions, but I do feel really good that we paid attention to so many of those things back in the 1980s, because they did end up being important in the 1990s and in the last decade. And the incredible people who either invent them or led them, have gone on to become remarkably successful in things, post their Apple days. And that feels good, to know that, those people, got some support when they needed it, when no one paid much attention to their ideas, and now that their ideas have become a reality.
Well, if I could just make a quick observation, just so about the Knowledge Navigator and the Newton, if you'll indulge me, I'll give you a term I coined. It's called, and I wrote I wrote an article about it last year, so on my blog. I call it the third tier of personal computing. Essentially, you had the first tier was established with a desktop computer, and then ultimately the laptop or notebook, even as we know it today, established the second tier of personal computing. And then what I suggest, ultimately the iPhone in 2007, and thus the Android devices, not to take away from the BlackBerry, which I know you have one, but finally developed the third tier, because I feel like the most important aspect of it wasn't just internet access, but a true desktop quality web browser. But so basically these things all came together into, like what you say, are billions and billions now. And a lot of the technologies, like one you spoke of, HyperCard, and I know another interview, this is with CNET, I think in 2005, you had said that you wish you had you felt HyperCard was a big missed opportunity. What you wish you had done more with it. And I think you probably did as much as you could have with it. And by the way, I learned how to program with HyperCard, other than just basic programming. But basically you had CDs came out, which you could have access to a large amount of data, pictures and encyclopedias and such. And that lasted for a while. Then the internet came out, didn't need that anymore. So essentially HyperCard, once the internet came out, didn't need HyperCard anymore, because you had the internet with hyperlinks and such. So anyway, these technologies came together in what we know as a smartphone. So the smartphone, to cut this to the chase, is the third tier of personal computing. It exists now. And all of this has come together from Alan Kay's Dynabook concepts to, of course, the iPad being kind of along those lines too.
Well, one of the insights Alan gave me back when he was my guide in the 1980s, he said that when something first comes on the market in technology, mm-hmm. it's usually a curiosity, and that's when the real geeks get interested in it, and they sort of tinker with it, and then it goes through another stage if it's going to move on to be successful, and that's where people say, gee, it's more than a curiosity, it's actually productive. And he said, this is now in the 1980s, he said personal computing started out with the homebrew computer club and the geeks and mm-hmm. People Hobbyists. Trying to build their own personal computer and the Altair and things of that sort. And then you had those leaders who emerged, like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, who actually created an industry around it. And so they took us to the era from a curiosity into something productive.
Right. People need to get work done.
Right. And that was the personal computer era. And then remember, this is now the 1980s, and Alan's talking mm-hmm. to me. And he said, in the future, we're going to another generation which goes beyond productivity, and it goes to indispensable. And he said, something becomes indispensable when you can't live without it if someone takes it away from you. Mm-hmm. And so as we thought about PDAs, and when I was preparing for that speech to CES in 1993, that was the context in which I was making the prediction. I said there's going to be a device called the PDA, or at least we've named it the PDA, that is going to be held in your hand. It'll have amazing communications capability. You'll have an incredible, easy user interface. It'll be very powerful, be able to manipulate content. And there are going to be billions of them because it's going to be indispensable.
Mm-hmm. And it is now. Yeah. And it's the perfect name.
At the time, and you can probably go back and, yeah, and if you go back and look at the articles that came out after that speech, you know, you'll see that I was ridiculed over the speech, you know, because they thought I was claiming that Apple was going to introduce Newton and would sell a billion. Mm-hmm. And I said, gee, it's just amazing to me that everyone knows I'm not a computer scientist, but they do think I'm a marketing guy. You know, what marketing guy would ever go out and say he's going to sell a billion of anything, you know, when he first introduced the product? How could anyone possibly think that's what I'm suggesting? But, you know, again, as we know, it's not what really happens. It's what, you know, people think that happens. So the myth usually supersedes reality.
Well, I know you've expressed that, you know, these weren't all your visions, or, you know, they weren't ideas you necessarily originally came up with. But even to, I think, to see, what am I trying to say here? I mean, do you feel vindicated now, though, with the Knowledge Navigator concept? Don't you feel, it sounds like it, don't you feel like you're ahead of your time, but you recognized it? So, you know, maybe you didn't originate all the ideas, but you recognized the concepts as valid. Here's
the way I think about it. First of all, I'm at a stage in my life where I don't really have any need inside of me to get recognition for anything. So I'm not out to, you know, try to claim credit for something. The way I think about things is you sort of step back at your life and you say, okay, you know, I was, you know, good at some things and I was less good at other things, but what was I really good at? And when I think about what I'm really good at, and pretty consistently, no matter what business I've been in, I've always been good at systems design. I'm a designer by training, by love, by I'm a very visual type learner. I like to take complex problems and to simplify them, and then to be able to connect the dots and be able to explain it in ways that make sense to people. So that's what my skill is. And it was my skill in marketing. It was my skill in, I think, when I was at Apple. So when I look back and say, what was my role in all of this? I wasn't the inventor. But I was able to connect the dots, and I was able to, you know, understand the generalized principles that others like Steve or Alan Kay, you know, came up with, and figure out, so when do you need to go in and support an individual, whether it's, you know, Bill Atkinson or, you know, Steve Perlman or, you know, Larry Tesler or these various individuals who really did play, you know, incredibly important, you know, roles in the technology that we have today. I remember reading a quote about the quote that Einstein said, and it really made so much sense to me. He said, "You don't really understand something complex unless you can explain it in a simple way." And really, that's what I think I do in marketing. You know, I try to take complex things and try to explain them in simple ways that will be, you know, inspirational and motivating to people, and hopefully they'll want to buy something that we're selling. And it's no more complicated than that. And the thing I learned from Alan Kay was he used to say that you know, point of view is worth 80 IQ points. And so his guidance to me was, John, you need to expand your point of view so that you can understand, you know, things from different perspectives. I was on the media lab board at MIT for about 15 years, and Marvin Minsky was there at that time. He was, you know, sort of the father of artificial intelligence, and mm-hmm. I used to spend a lot of time with Marvin. And Marvin had a great saying. He said, "You don't really understand something till you understand it more than one way." And when you think about what Einstein said with, you know, you don't understand something complex, you can explain it in a simple way, that you don't understand something until you understand it more than one way, Marvin Minsky or Alan Kay saying, you know, point of view is worth 80 IQ points. I'd say that my contribution is I'm a person who is insatiably curious and interested to learn. I'm willing to put in sort of the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of hard work to really try to study something and learn about it. I'm willing to take high risks. It was a high risk for me to go to Apple. I mean, people in the corporate America thought I'd lost my mind to go join the number four company in the personal computer industry that no one even heard of the personal computer in most cases, and give up, you know, a terrific, you know, career at Apple, at Pepsi. Yeah. So, you know, I've always been a risk taker and a person led by curiosity, and a person who loves to connect the dots and loves to be around talented people and likes to make bets on people. And I think that's my contribution to it all. You know, I was, you know, on the team, but I had a real cool seat on the bus.
Well, John, I know we probably need to wrap it up. Do you mind if I ask you just a few more kind of quick questions?
Sure.
These are slightly fluffier. So do you think the historical perspective of your time running Apple will change in the future? And what I mean by that is Apple, the company. I guess, I mean, can you ever imagine maybe, you know, Apple's built their new campus, you know, the flying saucer one they're going to build in the next few years, beautiful building. And maybe they might have a corridor with lined with pictures of past CEOs.
No.
Can you ever imagine that?
I think that's a horrible idea.
Okay. I mean, don't some businesses do that? I've never been an executive, but I thought that, you know, you're supposed to like honor your past executives. And,
No. I think the what makes Apple wonderful, and there's so many things that do, is that Apple is synonymous with Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs is synonymous with Apple.
And a lot like Walt Disney is.
Yeah,
what I felt too.
There's only one person who should be identified in a leadership role with Apple in what it has become. I don't know what it'll be in the future, but in what it has become, there's only one person that should be identified in that way. So that would be an absurd idea.
Do you ever get any fan mail? People that admired you when you ran Apple, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I actually do. I mean, it sounds strange, but
it's not strange.
I still get recognized. I mean, a lot of it happens to be more if I go to China, if I go to, I was just in Prague recently, and some people recognize me, and you know, I'll be in India, and people will recognize me, and it tends to be, you know, in other parts of the world. And many people, you know, read Odyssey. Remember, Odyssey was written before the Berlin Wall came down. And it was, for a number of people, the first, you know, glimpse of, you know, of what was possible in the West. You know, I still have people who have come back decades later and said, gee, that book changed, you know, my whole world. And, you know, thanks for writing it and things like that. So that makes me feel good because I like, I don't really want any recognition. What makes me feel good is to know that there are things that I was involved with that, you know, touched other people's lives in ways that they felt were important. But I'm not interested in any recognition.
That's good to hear. And I think even the strongest personality who you can feel good about yourself and confident, I think it's always good to hear some outside confirmation of, you know, I recognize you did something that was good. I like it, and so on.
Yeah. Well, the major role I have today, I don't have a bright line between work and fun. As they say, you know, Americans live to work and Europeans work to live.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah. So I don't need to work, but I work every day. But I work with no title. I'm a mentor to a number of entrepreneurs, and I'm, in these days, very focused on healthcare, because I think that the same brilliant talent that created the productivity decades with personal computing and has created the smartphones and, you know, the reinvention of every consumer industry in the last decade, that same innovative talent, not necessarily the same people, but that kind of entrepreneurial creative talent can be brought to bear on healthcare. So my focus really for the last 7 years has been on healthcare. And I have I'm involved in, you know, about a half dozen startup companies, all working with different aspects of healthcare. And we're doing it much the way when I was at Apple, you know, working on the Knowledge Navigator. We're not trying to solve the whole problem in one company, you know, but we're working on different aspects of the problem in different companies. And it's actually the most fun time in my entire life. And if I hadn't have had the experience of the decade at Apple, you know, I never would be able to be doing the kinds of things I'm doing today, because I was exposed to just what's possible when you put talented people onto exciting problems.
Yeah, I just found you in the news here, you know, earlier today. John Sculley, former Apple CEO, backs new health sensor startup Misfit Wearables. Yep. So that was in the news just a couple of weeks ago. Well, see, two more real quick questions. And do you remember the film Pirates of Silicon Valley? You know, where obviously you were depicted by an actor.
I did, but you know,
did you like that?
I never watched any of these things. I never actually watched. And I still haven't even read the book on Steve Jobs that Walter Isaacson did. I'm a great admirer of Walter Isaacson, and I gave interviews for the book. But it was just too emotionally difficult for me to read it, so I haven't read it.
Okay, I understand. I just didn't know if you liked the guy's depiction of you or not in that movie. I think it was okay. Obviously, I don't know you personally or anything. So yeah. Last question is, have you considered writing a new book, or along the lines of Odyssey? I guess it would be more obviously more updated with your life. Or, I mean, have you considered updating Odyssey? Would there be an update? Or
no.
Okay.
I have no interest to write another book. It seems to me that there's some terrific books that have been written about the things that I was involved with. You know, the Cult of Mac is one of them. You know, Inside Steve Jobs' Brain is another. Mm-hmm. Walter Isaacson's book, from everything I hear, is terrific. So there's really no need for a book like that. I'm interested in doing what I do, and I still give speeches around the world, but it's largely about the things I'm curious about and the things I'm working on. It's really not, I'm not there to talk about Apple or Pepsi right. or things in the past.
Understand. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say or like to add to our conversation?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. And since you're a historian, you can go and fact check. And it's pretty accurate.
Yeah, everything you've said, it pretty much lines up with all my research. So thank you again. Have a good night and happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.
All right. Bye-bye. So there you go. I want to again thank John for spending the time with me, and I think this interview could lead many to a new perception of John Sculley and stimulate further research and discussion on his years running Apple Computer. I'd like to close with a quick quote from a New York Times article dated October 16th, 1993, by John Markoff. There's a bit of criticism in the article, but the title and this quote really stand out. The title is, "Visionary Apple Chairman Moves On." The quote is, "His contribution to the field was significant," said Nicholas Negroponte, the director of the Media Laboratory at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. "He can almost single-handedly be credited with America's re-entry to consumer electronics."